Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Sarah Bender, who's a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and a professor of political science at George Washington University, where she specializes in Congress and legislative politics. She's an associate editor of the Washington Post Monkey Cage blog and co-author of Advice and Dissent, The Struggle to Shape the Federal Judiciary, and the author of Stalemate, Causes and Consequences of Legislative Gridlock. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Bender.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Sarah. And what do you make of Donald Trump's recent about-face in the Oval Office? Because it seems to me that there's a possibility that the Democrats have been crowing, particularly on MSNBC, about how Chuck and Nancy basically smoked Paul Ryan and McConnell. But is it also possible that Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell were secretly relieved that they didn't have to face a showdown with their rebellious Tea Party caucuses threatening to shut down the government over the debt ceiling?
Well, I think you put your finger on precisely everything that's been going on here in Washington, right? And the issue was really twofold, if not threefold. First, this is a really unpredictable president. And he is unmoored, right? He's unattached to any ideology or even any particular policy prescriptions, generally. He wants to win. He wants to make deals. And the second factor he eventually seems to have figured out is this is a very divided Republican Party in Washington. You could call it a civil war going on inside the party. You could call it a deep ideological cleavage in that party. But Ryan, the House Speaker, and McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, they don't command a majority. They don't have a procedural majority to proceed on the big issues of the day, on the Republican agenda. And that has left an opening for the Democrats, who do have an agenda on which they are united, in part because they're in the minority, they're out of power. And Trump walked right into I don't want to call it a trap, but he walked right into an opening or a plan that the two Democratic leaders laid for him, which is to sort of grab him in on a popular issue here, in particular on the fate of DACA recipients.
So in terms of the Chuck and Nancy romance, it does seem that it was unfortunate that Chuck was caught on a hot mic talking about how much Trump really likes him, which I'm not sure plays well with the Democratic base. But on the other hand, even talk of any kind of DACA deal is driving Trump's base crazy. So how is he going to navigate that? Because it's, you know, he's sent so many mixed signals and mixed statements and tweets about whether or not his wall will be built or be part of a deal to save the Dreamers.
Well, for sure. I think it would be premature to say that it's a done deal, that DACA recipients will be protected, let alone what a DACA bill would look like. There's politics here on both sides of the aisle, right? For the Republicans, as you mentioned, right, this immigration really, it's not on an issue on congressional Republicans' agenda, right? Neither really was health care. These aren't the issues they want to be legislating on, right? And by virtue of reaching across to Chuck and Nancy, Trump is driving this wedge, right, within the Republican Party. Those who are hardcore on the wall, hardcore on deporting undocumented people who are here, hardcore in deporting DACA, versus a more, the call them centrist, maybe moderate, I'm not so sure, but other parts or more establishment parts of the Republicans who see an economic reason for, at least for protecting DACA and others. But of course, right, the proof is in the pudding here, where Republicans come down and whether Trump is going to actually enunciate a policy where he takes a stand, right? Is it going to be path to citizenship? Is it just extending these temporary work permits for DACA? Is it border security? Is it, what does that look like? I think Republicans, as you said, look, Ryan and McConnell almost grateful that, you know, their responsibility here is little diminished here. I think they're going to lay it on the White House. take a stand, produce a package, and you build majorities. So it's unclear to me precisely how Republicans are going to maneuver their way, but some of it will depend on Trump, right, taking a position and sticking to it, which, of course, he didn't do on health care. And that's part of why that civil war and the Republicans over repeal and replace kind of devoured their policy.
And again, I'm speaking with Sarah Binder, a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and a professor of political science at George Washington University, where she specializes in Congress and legislative politics. She's an associate editor of the Washington Post Monkey Cage blog and co-author of Advice and Dissent, The Struggle to Shape the Federal Judiciary, and the author of Stalemate, Causes and Consequences of Legislative Gridlock. But how do you explain, though, why Trump consistently panders to a shrinking minority, roughly around 35%. And of course, this minority is now going to be riled up even more by Stephen Bannon, who, along with a billionaire backer, Robert Mercer, who was the largest donor to the Trump campaign, they apparently are going to start funding Tea Party candidates for the Senate and House to run against Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell's anointed or incumbent candidates.
Well, you know, you and I look at opinion polls. We see surveys. We see the public approval rating. Generally, we see that 35%, right? That the president's base, real hardcore base, seems to be a small sliver of the public, but I would probably say a sizable majority of the Republicans. So you and I see a minority of the population, but I don't think Trump sees it that way. He seems to think his election is owed to rallying those that hardcore base, and he seems to draw like some sort of energy or sustenance from appealing to that group. Of course, you know, going backing track on the wall could put that at jeopardy, which is probably why you see him backtracking a little bit this week. No deal, right? We didn't shake a deal. We're still going to do the wall, right? He seems to be wanting to have it both ways.
But he seems to be predisposed to the furthest right-wing conspiratorial thinking from the Alex Jones world, from Breitbart, who really are about provocation as opposed to illumination. Or any kind of policies. It's just the bomb-throwing wing. And it seems like for the longest time they've been able to slip stuff to him that's, you know, on the along the lines of the kind of Russian misinformation that we're finding out is on Facebook. And apparently the bodyguard's left now, so at least General Kelly is able to put in front of Trump what's actually happening in the real world, whether or not he takes the presidential daily briefings or not, we still don't know. But it's an amazing situation, isn't it, to have a president who really, traffics in alternative facts.
Well, for sure. And I think part of the disconnect here between those of us who study politics and those of us who read read papers and study history and politics is that we're used to politicians having some sort of ideological mooring, right? Whether it's on the far left or the far right or centrist, we expect them to maintain a sort of consistency of positions. But I don't think that's the worldview of Donald Trump. I don't think he sees that there's a cost to his public reputation for siding with the hardcore populist right. I don't think he sees politics in that sort of left-right map. And you're not committed to particular policy precision, and you're not committed to a certain ideological what issues go with which. It seems Trump thinks he can reach across the aisle, and, right? And from his worldview, there's Chuck and Nancy ready to make a deal. I think he sees the world as deal making, and he sees it about how does he come out ahead. That's not really what we're used to seeing in the White House, and it allows him, or it seems to empower him, to be all over the map, right? And seemingly not pay a cost on many issues for some really out of the mainstream views, right? Certainly in the views expressed after Charlottesville.
But prior to that, the people that were hired in his cabinet and in the key positions inside the government pretty much fit the pattern of putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank. And there's, inescapable hostility to government itself with people like Scott Pruitt and others. So what explains that? Here you have a president who's now figuring out, I got to find a way to make government work, when he's hired a whole bunch of people dedicated to, as Stephen Bannon said, deconstructing the administrative state.
Well, then the question is, how much does Trump know what's going on within these bureaucracies that to whom he's right appointed these leaders? I think he sees this cabinet in terms of loyalty to him. I mean, you and I can map all these, Rick Pruitt, DeVos. We can map all these heads of the departments in sort of the sort of hardcore Republican, right? They sort of fit this conservative Republican ideology. But I don't know that's how Trump thinks about what they're doing. And to the extent that they fit a sort of deregulation, a tearing down EPA, sort of removing what was Obama had put into place, I think that's how Trump sees the world. Now, the question I think comes for the Democrats and pressures from the base on Schumer and Pelosi. What type of deals are you making? And are you really, by virtue of shaking hands, say, on DACA, or are you putting sort of normalizing what's going on within the bureaucracy? And those are the pressures on the left, which have not really come to the fore yet, but I think we'll continue to see if this type of reaching across the aisle continues from Trump out of the White House.
Well, exactly. I think a lot of Democrats were unsettled by Chuck Schumer's, you know, schoolgirl giddiness that Trump likes him. Not exactly what they want to hear, I don't think.
I assume Schumer and Pelosi will make this argument as the time comes, which is to say, look, we are out of power, and yet we have got the White House moving on our issues, right? And certainly, right, a longstanding priority of the Democrats has been immigration reform and a path to citizenship for those who are here undocumented. Mm-hmm. And to think that in unified Republican control, that it looks like there could be a deal that addresses a hardcore Democratic interest, I fully expect Schumer and Pelosi to start articulating that argument, right, which is really almost unheard for in the last sort of post-war period when we've had unified party control.
So do you think that the Democrats have figured out something which seems pretty apparent, that Donald Trump's previous employment as a reality TV star is really where he's at, because he spends an inordinate amount of time watching television to see how his reality TV show, The American Presidency, is playing. It's almost like an actor who's more interested in the reviews than actually doing the performance. And one wonders exactly how much time he spends actually doing the job, or how engaged he is in doing the job. So do you think that is a key here, that that this is a paradoxical man who has said some very hateful things, about Mexicans and praised the Nazis in Charlottesville, but at the same time he clearly wants to be loved?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think that was, and I think Nancy Pelosi and I think Chuck Schumer understand that about him and want to exploit it, right? Find issues on which there's strong public support, not necessarily within his base, but strong broad public support, and even, say, from business interests, right? And the DACA issue really fits that. Right, where the headlines and the pictures after he announced that they're ending it or were going to end the DACA program, those are pretty, I think my hunch is he heard a lot from a lot of different quarters saying, what are you doing? And he seems to be motivated by those types of headlines. Now, I don't want to push that argument too far, right? The reaction to what he said in the wake of Charlottesville was really, really hard from all, right, corners many corners of the Republican Party, and certainly from Democrats, and certainly from business interests, right? We saw everybody stepping down from those councils he had set up. And the councils were just there for optics, I think, in the first place, right? But the president has never really stepped back from what he said after Charlottesville. And so I think we'll be a little cautious here on how much he's motivated by the headlines, mm-hmm. right?
Well, he doubled down on Charlottesville just the other day.
That does give one pause when we say that he doesn't seem to have something that he believes in, but he seems to be quite committed mm-hmm. on this far-right sort of nationalism, sort of white nationalism. I don't know if he quite understands what he's saying, but that's certainly what's forecast from him. So we just be a little cautious on how much he's motivated, but certainly on these DACA issues, and perhaps we'll see this later, perhaps on something like infrastructure, he seems motivated by the headlines.
Well, just in closing, I watched Hillary Clinton speaking the other day on the Rachel Maddow program, and there's been some negative press about her, sort of whining about losing and not taking responsibility, et cetera. But frankly, that didn't seem to be the case in this interview. What came across to me is that how incredibly sad it is that a very qualified person is not the president of the United States, and an extremely unqualified person is. And so how do you see the Democrats going forward? Do you think the country in any way is recovering from its sort of spasm of the ecstasy of anger and now may want some competence? My fear is the Democrats are too invested in impeachment and not invested enough in coming up with a new narrative, candidates, and a vision going forward.
Well, I mean, I think most likely the two ways to think about it here, the public, large portions of the public do remain angry, and I think that's something that Hillary Clinton says, which is, look, I was giving them policy prescriptions, and they wanted me to be angry. I think this, the future for the Democrats, I don't know that what we saw in that election between someone without governing or any governing experience and someone with, I think, very little conception of public service, right, beating from the Electoral College vote, someone who has spent her career in public service and in pursuit of policy goals. I don't know that that's the last time we'll see that type of election, right? So long as there's dissatisfaction and so long as there are candidates like Donald Trump who they stoked it, right? You have to, if you give voters a choice like that, some of them, not a majority of voters, but a majority of the Electoral College, took that choice. I don't know that that's something that goes away quite so quickly. And for the Democrats, of course, at least for those who plot elections, they know in 2018 is a referendum on Trump. It's not a do we like the Democrats or Republicans better. It's like what do you think of the Republicans governing? So until we get past 2018 and closer into, past that election, Democrats are going to be kind of feeling their way around, seeing what's coming next.
Well, Sarah Bender, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Sarah Bender, who's a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and a professor of political science at George Washington University, where she specializes in Congress and legislative politics. She's an associate editor of the Washington Post's Monkey Cage blog and co-author of Advice and Dissent, The Struggle to Shape the Federal Judiciary, and the author of Stalemate, Causes and Consequences of Legislative Gridlock. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into another outbreak of unrest in St. Louis following the acquittal of a white police officer who was charged with first-degree murder for shooting a black man following a high-speed chase.